Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, my name's John Carosella, and I'm your host for Convergence on Firefly Willows LIVE. Convergence is to consciousness as gravity is to the material world. In small amounts, gravity is overwhelmed by every other fundamental force of the universe. But gravity has something nothing else has. It's cumulative. The more matter you collect, the more gravity you get, until it becomes the most powerful force of the material world. I think convergence is like that too. Only in this case, we're working with truth. The more truth we collect, the more convergence we experience. Connections, relationships, resonance of ideas and concepts, science and mysticism. Lately, deep truths just seem to be coming together, even as many of the illusions around us are falling apart. As within, so without. As above, so below. I know I'm feeling it, and I'll bet you are too. For the next 90 minutes, we'll be exploring concepts and topics that in some way or another bring us around to a deeper truth. Join me and my guests for this week's experience of Convergence.
Hi, and thanks for joining us for today's program. Join John in conversation with Taoist Wicca founder and priestess, Susie Lady Red Hawk Peltier. Today, John and Susie explore the Celtic holiday of Samhain, or Halloween as we know it here in the U.S. The veils between the worlds are thin, the door to the spirit world is open, and death is close at hand. If that makes you uncomfortable, listen in as John shares how death became one of his spirit allies and what he learned from death in the ritual of the sacred hunt. We invite you to sign in and join us in the chat room at blogtalkradio.com. Next up, the Firefly Willows LIVE Roundtable is an opportunity for all of our hosts to come together, share their thoughts, experience, and insights on a variety of topics. Today's moderator is John Carosella with our topic, Keeping Death at a Distance. What are we missing?
Welcome to the Firefly Willows LIVE Roundtable. I'm your host, John Carosella. I'll be moderating a discussion with my co-hosts, Deb Carosella.
Morning.
Mildred Lynn McDonald.
Good morning.
And High C Lovers.
Hello.
So it is the month of October and heading toward the end of October. This is the time of year when the last of the harvest comes in and the leaves come off the trees. And basically this is, we're watching the year come to a close. We're watching the lively part of the year draw to an end. And as part of that, we in the Celtic tradition, we have a celebration of the feast of or the ceremony of Samhain, which we know as Halloween here in the United States. And this time of year and this ceremony draws our attention to a topic that most of us find uncomfortable, and that is death. So what I'd like to put on the table for this week's roundtable is death, in a way. We, in our culture, don't spend a lot of time or attention on contemplating or understanding the nature of death and how death flows in and out of our experience. And I'm wondering, what would our culture be like and how would we be differently if instead of keeping death at arm's length the way we do, we had a healthier relationship with the fact that death is part of life, that it's something that everyone and everything goes through. And as even as we treasure the experience of living, having a more complete and familiar understanding of the nature of death as part of that living experience. What would be different in our lives and in our culture and our society if we had a better understanding and relationship with death?
Well, one thing that comes to mind for me is something that Mildred mentioned, that in our society we have a tendency to marginalize our older people, our elders, and they don't have the same standing in our culture and in our sense of value once you reach a certain age. And I believe that perhaps we wouldn't do that to them. We wouldn't diminish their value. We wouldn't marginalize them. We wouldn't want to put them somewhere where we weren't confronted by them and by the obvious effects of age on the human body if we were more comfortable with that part of what life was like, what that stage of life was like, where that was the piece of life just before the inevitable death part of life.
And so, and what would we gain from that if we had kept our elders at less distance?
Well, the value that their life experiences could be shared with us, or even the acceptance perhaps on some of the older generation that things were winding down. And you know what? I'm going to go. And for many older people, I believe they're okay with that. They're ready. It's like, you know what? I'm tired. I've done it. And it was great while I was here, but I'm done. I'm tired. And to know that and to see that there are people that accept it, not necessarily are running towards it, but they accept it and they're at peace with it, I think would allow us to not fear and to also appreciate the value and the lessons that they learned, our elders in particular, up to that point. And we might be more aware and more cognizant of what was happening in our lives, even though we aren't yet perhaps at the same age or stage as those elders.
So we'd be more receptive to the lessons of elderhood.
Yes.
Simply by being closer to them.
Yeah, we would have role models, and we would know how to enter that stage ourselves.
Right.
Rather than floundering around like a fish at the bottom of a boat.
Mm-hmm.
Just, we don't really know what to do because we're not exposed to it on a daily basis, and so we're not able to observe the process, to intuit the process, or integrate the process.
Mm. Yeah, and I see you mentioned something about our obsession with youth culture as another artifact of this.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think one thing that would change in our society is we'd see a whole shift in economies, because the amount of money that is spent on plastic surgeries and beauty products and all sorts of stuff that are supposed to keep us young or young looking would become far less important, because there wouldn't be this idea that any aspect or any sign of getting older is somehow bad. And, you know, when you mention role models, how often, especially in our celebrity-driven culture, how often is a role model someone that is older? Versus the role models are always these young people, whether it's an athlete or an actor, actress, singer, you know, whatever. And how much of a role model can they really be? I mean, if they're 23, how much wisdom and experience do they really have? And then we spend a lot of time making excuses. Oh, well, you know, that's just, they're 23, that little drunken binge, you know, and then they're like, oh, I have to remember not to do that because I'm a role model and people look up to me. Well, if we looked up to people that actually had the wisdom and experience of older people, then they would have already learned that drunken binges are not very productive, and that's not what you need to do in order to be happy, et cetera. And, you know, and it's interesting to me, the what is considered old keeps getting pushed back into younger and younger, younger age. I mean, you have teenagers that are getting Botox or getting plastic surgery, or, you know, a 16-year-old, there was an actress that was going to be on a TV show, 16 years old, that went in to have plastic surgery because she was worried about lines that might be showing in close-ups because she was going to be on television. She was normally a singer, so she was going to be on television.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
You know, and so this idea is so prevalent and pervasive, and it's as if anything that has to do with getting older, which I think then implies to people death, because it's this clear indication that you move towards it, is just so fearful for people that they just don't even know what to do with it.
So bringing ourselves closer to death and having death as part of the conversation or part of the
cultural awareness
has a lot of effects, starting with the way we distance our elders and how that ripples all the way through our culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
What about the aspect of dying that is the finality of it, the something is definitively ending?
Well, we don't even want to accept that because, you know, whether it's phrases we use like rest in peace, or we don't even want to see the body until it's been taken to the undertaker who does their embalming and everything else, so that if we do see it at the funeral, it looks like a person sleeping
rather than
mm-hmm. a dead person, because we just don't want to have to see or acknowledge and accept that the person is dead versus, oh, let me just look at them sleeping peacefully, you know? And it's like, but that's not what they're doing. You know, I mean, well, I could go into a whole thing.
Well, but that's not what their body is doing, right?
That's just the physical body at that point. So, you know, all the money that we spend on funerals and all of that kind of stuff just seems so ridiculous to me, because it's all for just the
compost.
Shell.
It's all for compost.
Right. And yet it can't compost if you embalm and put the casket in the box and everything else.
Yeah, I was speaking to a woman at a retreat this past weekend. She is part of a open air cremation function that is one of two in the United States that are approved. And this one's in Crestone, Colorado, where they actually have an end of life project to help people become more aware of their choices at death. She had some interesting perspectives, but the idea that here in this country we are now starting to acknowledge that there's another way to say goodbye to the remains of a body, and in this particular case, open air cremation on a pyre.
Mm-hmm. Or even the fact that it's illegal to bury a body. You know, that there's only like one or two in the country green cemeteries
mm-hmm.
where you can just wrap the body in a cotton cloth or something and put it in just a wood box and put it in the ground so that it will all decompose.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that that is so rare and so over-regulated that somehow the natural process of things is
arrested
against law.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Seems so ridiculous.
So what would be different? If we were comfortable with things ending, you know, whether it's a career or a relationship or a hobby or...
I think I'd like to go back a little bit to the stuff we were just talking about, because as everybody was sharing their thoughts, what was hitting me was that we, our souls chose to come to the earth plane to experience the joy of being alive. And that entails all of the cycles of life.
Including death.
So basically, we are robbing ourselves of something our humanness gives us, a beautiful experience our humanness gives us in its fullness. And as I was starting to think about that, I was also thinking about, by not letting ourselves have that experience, we are out of sync with nature, the cycles of nature.
Right.
Then where I went with that was, well, there has been a belief that we are here to master nature. So where there's a belief that man is here to master nature. You know, man, it's man's domain here. Is man thinking they're also here to master death? And does that thinking come from the same level of consciousness?
Oh, yeah. I bet it does.
Mm-hmm.
I bet it does.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is mastery is not control. They're not the same things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we confuse, in the case that you're pointing out, we confuse mastery with control. We're trying to control nature, and we're trying to control death, and that's not the same as having a mastery in the presence of and in conjunction with,
mm-hmm.
right? If you have mastery, you are present and fully engaged with whatever it is that's happening, right? So if you have mastery of death, then you are fully engaged with it and understand how to co-create with it. And that's a funky word with death, because we think of death as being destruction and decay, but it is that which makes room for what comes next.
And it's not destruction and decay for the compost or fertilizer that you would be providing for the earth.
Right.
That's the seedbed.
This is the releasing and letting go, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is why even in the notion of our daily lives, of our routines, of our habits, of our hobbies, of our relationships, sometimes allowing death to participate frees us, because we completely let go, and return all of that energy back to the universe as compost. And when we don't do that, we're taking up space that prevents something new from emerging. So there really is a fundamental incompatibility with making room for something new that can enhance our lives when we keep death at a distance.
So maybe we need a new story. There's the creationist story about Adam and Eve, which everybody is familiar with, most people. Maybe there needs to be a beautiful exiting story.
And I wonder, actually, I imagine that many cultures and many religious tapestries include those threads. But for some reason, we've chosen not to look at that part.
Yeah, but the most prevalent one in our society, with Christianity being kind of the prevalent religion of the overculture, there actually isn't one, because it's offset. Because the only real primary death story that you get Bible is one that comes back to life. So you don't. He's only dead for 3 days.
Right. And it is the resurrection of the body, not the resurrection of the consciousness or the soul or the spirit.
Right. And so even there, you don't, with the creation story, you don't have a death story woven in.
But with the Christian story.
Yeah.
Where's the Armageddon story? Because I was just curious if the duality of the creation story is it an end of the world story that other cultures have, or is it a transitional story? Because I don't actually know. Is it literally a end, or is it a...
It's a transition, but so there's two things in there. One, you have an out, so you don't have to suffer
in the story. Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're faced with eternal damnation in hell. Right. Well, if you don't follow this. But also it is a transition story, because ultimately what comes is the New Jerusalem,
yeah,
or something.
Years,
so then you have this 1,000 years of peace kind of thing. So
it's
again,
heaven on earth at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So again, it's not really a death, because
mm-hmm.
you're not letting go of anything. You're just getting a more perfected aspect of it.
Well, I think, you know, what would be fascinating is to look at the book of Revelations as a story of death, and to look at it not in terms of what we would be avoiding, but in terms of what we would be letting go of. And to read that apocalyptic story as, okay, what are we letting go of in this process, in this the introduction of this chaos? Because that might actually illuminate a very different side of this story that we have trained our vision not to see. Because we don't want to let go of things. We want to hold on to everything. Because letting go makes us feel
powerless,
vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Because we fear scarcity, and it makes us feel adrift, which in a sense makes us feel helpless and vulnerable again. And I think that's another aspect of understanding and embracing death as part of culture, is that sometimes, you know, when you die, you're very vulnerable, right? That's the ultimate moment of vulnerability, is when you let go of your ability to control yourself in this reality. And we don't ever even approach that. And so we're constantly fighting, pushing back against it.
And we all do have a survival instinct, too.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So that comes to play at the reptilian brain.
Mm-hmm.
Or even more than the mammalian brain, too, right? There's a joy in being here, mm-hmm. on this plane,
mm-hmm.
right,
mm-hmm.
as you pointed out. So the survival instinct is there to keep us in the game.
Mm-hmm.
But what would we learn if we recognize that there are many games within the game, and we can go through that letting go and that dying process with career, with belief systems? You know what? We could die to a belief system, right? And be okay with that, and be vulnerable in that, and then come up with a new belief system that suits our new self, for example. But we're not trained.
Well, I think the marginalization and the avoidance of death, whether it's literal death or what you're talking about in terms of career, belief system, et cetera, is something that is greatly contributed to or exacerbated an overall sense of dis-ease, emotionally and mentally, for people, because it feels so foreign that we don't know how to respond or deal with it emotionally. And so then we get stuck in this cycle of grief or this, I don't know where to go with this because I'm overwhelmed by emotion. Whereas if it was something that was a reality for us that we had already thought about or knew was simply a part of the fabric of life, we would, I don't think, be quite so overwhelmed and overcome by emotion in an unhealthy way.
Yeah.
When death comes, whether it's in literal death or the death, you know, the loss of a job or the changing of a belief system. And for me, having studied Buddhism, one thing that Buddhism actually stresses is you should think about your death every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've tried practicing that. And it doesn't mean that you aren't emotional when someone or something dies. It just means that you move through it perhaps in a more graceful way or in a healthier way. You know, it would probably sound weird to people, but every day I think about the death of my dog.
Mm.
And it's so that when that actually happens, I will have already kind of been through that emotional experience and will be able to then move through it rather than to feel like a tidal wave has overwhelmed me and is drowning me because I had so avoided and pretended like this was never going to happen that now I don't know what to do with it because now the reality has slapped me in the face.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot more we can cover here. Everything from the prevalence of death in our media and our entertainment, right? Like with this unhealthy fascination with murder and horror movies and slasher movies and so on, to our relationship with the food we eat and, you know, being a carnivore and not witnessing the growth, thriving, and death of those animals that nourish us. But we're out of time.
We'll have to do the sequel, Dad.
We'll have to do the sequel.
We'll call that after that.
So thank you very much for joining us. I hope our audience has enjoyed this conversation. And if you have questions or want to participate further, we're on Facebook. Stay tuned for the rest of the show. And we'll be right back.
Yeah, thanks guys. Thank
Bye.
You, John.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, that's our roundtable for this week. Many thanks to this week's moderator, John Carosella, and participants Mildred Lynn McDonald, Deb Carosella, and Heisi Lutmers. We hope you found this roundtable discussion engaging and thought-provoking. If you would like to join the conversation, visit facebook.com/fireflywillows and add your comment under this week's roundtable post. Stay tuned. Willows LIVE is proud to support Cimarron Sanctuary, a nonprofit organization where magic happens for horses and kids. Founded in 2010 and located in Petaluma, California, Cimarron Sanctuary provides a venue for assisting horses in need and facilitating the magic of horse and human communication. Cimarron Sanctuary takes in horses who need a home and/or a purpose, rescue horses, and adopts them until they can be placed in a permanent home or provides a lifelong home for them in the sanctuary. Their volunteers donate their time, energy, skills, and caring for the benefit of the horses and the kids of all ages who visit the sanctuary. What happens is magical and results in personal transformation for both the horses and the humans. A beautiful handshake across both sides of the fence. Find them at CimarronSanctuary.org. That's spelled CimarronSanctuary.org or email them at info@CimarronSanctuary.org. Donations to help the horses can be made online at CimarronSanctuary.org/donate. This tip of the week from Cimarron Sanctuary. Did you know that when children and adults are in the presence of horses, all of us benefit by becoming quiet, peaceful, and grounded? Petting a horse, and any animal for that matter, also lowers our blood pressure as well as our heart rate. Caring about an animal lengthens our lives and increases our ability to heal ourselves, feel contentment, and be peaceful.
Welcome back. This is Convergence, and I'm your host, John Carosella. Well, it's that time of year again. It's Samhain. Samhain is a major Celtic holiday. Arguably the most important and powerful holiday in the entire Celtic calendar. Certainly it's the holiday that is most recognizable to our modern culture and comes to us least disturbed from its historical roots. It's the non-kid version of Halloween, and Halloween evolved out of Samhain. So today I'd like to share with you some insights that I've received from the experience of Samhain and from the powers that surround the workings of Samhain. Back in 2010, I'd really just been getting to know Lady Red Hawk, but something inspired her to invite me to participate in her Wiccan Circle's Samhain ritual. Lady Red Hawk, or Susie Peltier as she's also known, does a superb job of crafting, preparing, and leading ritual. I didn't know much about Susie as Lady Red Hawk, the priestess. I knew her mostly as a practitioner of healing arts. But we had talked a bit about ritual and the role it could play in healing and advancing spiritual awakening. So I was intrigued at the prospect. When I received the Samhain ritual materials, I discovered that I was to be the sacred hunter, who in the ritual also plays the role of the horned one. There is a beautiful and powerful symmetry here. The hunter must become the hunted, and the hunted must surrender to the hunter, or the ritual fails. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So Samhain is a very important, powerful holiday in the Celtic calendar. What's it about? Well, death, actually. It's about death. Something we don't like to talk about and don't like to entertain much in our culture. We try to keep death at a distance as often as we can. Of course, that's impossible. What we do instead is hide from it, keep it away from our perceptions, and ignore it. But for some reason, I don't. I've been blessed to have many spiritual and an honorable share of physical encounters with death, to learn that death is a compassionate teacher and guide, and extremely elegant and sophisticated in purpose and action. Death, I've come to realize, is one of my most powerful, helpful allies. To some, this may sound creepy or repulsive, or crazy or dangerous. I wish I could assure you that it is not. It's nothing like that. Death is the most polite, discreet, and delicate guest one could ever have in one's retinue. It's only in our misunderstanding and immaturity that we treat death as the unwelcome guest. Because death makes us uncomfortable, we tell jokes. We make death the punchline. We treat death like we treated that weird kid that smelled funny and wears strange clothes. We mock, we insult, and we attempt to bully death. Think about that. Could anything be more ridiculous? I, for whatever reason, was led down a different path. I was guided to get to know death. I don't know why. Apparently, I was in need of assistance that only death could provide, which I received, by the way, several times over the last 3 years. But most significantly when I left my high-tech career, and again when I shed what appears to be the last remnants of an old, wounded, anxious self, just as I turned 51 this past April. Death was there to help me understand the passing of a dear elder cousin, and more recently with the passing of my father. I'll share more about death as an ally a little later in today's program, but I'd like to take you back to that Samhain ritual. In 2010. The evening was cool and clear. The regalia of the sacred hunter included a hood made from the skullcap and antlers of a deer. You've seen pictures of tribal hunters wearing headgear like that. To don this hood was to connect myself to thousands and thousands of years of humankind, as ancient as our awareness itself. The hunt goes back into the dim recesses of our collective memory. The ritual of Samhain calls the sacred hunter to account, to acknowledge the hunt and the willing sacrifice of the quarry to give its life so that the people may eat. Think about how long we have hunted. Think about the tools that we've used,
wooden spears and arrows harvested from the forest, with rough-hewn stone tips and bird feather fletchings, crude knives, literally sticks and stones. Imagine hunting a deer with such tools. Could you do it? Could you even get close? This is the world of the tribal hunter, where it's not about the power of the weapon. The weapons were the very weakest part of the hunter's assets. So what did the hunter rely upon? Stealth? Cunning? Skill? Certainly. But even that was not enough. Hunters were so revered because they provided something extraordinary to the tribe. To hunt and kill a game animal required more than skill and weapons. It required purity of heart and purity of purpose. It was the Samhain ritual that told me so. At the sacred moment in the ritual, I was transformed through invocation from the sacred hunter to the sacred quarry. As I opened my eyes, I saw the world differently. I was the horned one, the stag. I had become the object of the hunt. I looked at the puny humans around me. They were helpless. They were strange. They were inelegant and uncoordinated. They were a joke. And they were not pure. Not at all. The humans fairly stank of fear, confusion, jealousy, arrogance, and selfishness. They were wretched. And I was none of these things. I was clean. I was open. I lived a life of truth, of beauty, and justice, and balance. I lived a life of sovereignty over myself and communion with the creation. I was deer. I looked back at the humans. I'm going to sacrifice myself for this? I can still feel the initial wave of disgust wash over me. Disappointment. Diminishment. What a waste. And yet, some part of me acknowledged that this was as it must be. What was made clear to me in that moment was how essential it was to be a successful hunter, to be as pure of heart and clear of purpose as one could possibly be. For the game, the quarry you sought, could see you, could see clear into your heart and your motives and your wounds and your fears. It would have been trivial for a game animal to escape from those early human hunters. Their tools and their cunning would have been no match for my speed and my intimacy with the forest. A clean kill in those days could only come from a hunter who was truly the master of himself. Pure of heart, clear of purpose, no ego. As selfless as the game that willingly sacrificed itself. Or the game would bolt, and the hunt would fail. As the ritual proceeded, I could feel my connection to the thousands of years and millions of ancestors who had done this before me, both human and animal. I could feel the energy groove of the ritual of the hunt, and the hunt itself even deeper, as if it were an immense ocean swell of towering scale. And I was tuning into it, not just for myself, but for everyone else assembled. At first, it flickered in and out of my awareness, like a mirage. Then it became more present, more and more tangible, like the wind, but thicker, denser, undulating, drawing me in, into resonance with it. Honestly, it was the most powerful earth force I've ever experienced in my life. And then, the moment of truth. The kill. The sacrifice. The sacred quarry, the horned one, looked back one final time at those wretched, imperfect humans and committed. Surrendered. Hoping that the kill would be clean, the transition quick. And then into the darkness. and then I was awake. Awake, but lighter. Without a body. Still the sacred quarry, the horned one, sacrificed for the people. Trusting that, at another time, in another place, he would be reborn. And death, appearing silently to my left, barely nodded. The ritual, so expertly conducted by Lady Redhawk, continued on for several hours. But it was that moment, that recognition, that experience of surrender, that has stuck with me. Looking back, I recognize the wretchedness I saw in those humans as a lens on my own wounds and confusion and fear. Looking back, I can see that the sacrifice of the stag must be honored, not just in ritual, but in a daily walk of integrity. To be worthy of such a gift is no easy feat. To accept that sacrifice without being in a state of grace now feels, to me, to be a sin. Now, when I walk down the meat aisle in the grocery store, I feel a deep grief, a sadness. I fear that we are not mindful of the sacrifice. I fear that we are not mindful of the gift. I fear that we are not mindful of the sacredness. And death, standing silently to my left, barely nods. We'll be right back.
Enjoying today's show? Want to share it with a friend? Or maybe you've missed one of our previous programs. Well, you can always find the archives of our past shows on fireflywillows.com/live. Stop by and check out John's previous programs or shows from one of our other hosts, Mildred Lynn McDonald or Heisey Lutmers. Our live call-in shows are available too. Join us.
Welcome back. This is Convergence, and I'm your host, John Carosella. With me for this program's spirited conversation is Susie Peltier. Susie, also known as Lady Redhawk, is a priestess and founder of the Taoist Wiccan tradition based in San Francisco. Susie is a Reiki master and teacher, a holistic healer, and the host of Spiritually Speaking, currently airing on Seventh Wave Radio. Susie's current healing practice focuses on hypnotherapy and Reiki for mind-body-spirit integration. And Susie's been on the show before. In fact, she was my very first guest back in April, and I've had the privilege and pleasure of working with Susie and participating in some of her amazing rituals that follow the Celtic wheel,
the wheel of the year.
The wheel of the year. Okay.
Yeah, it's an agricultural calendar, basically. And then each tradition puts its own kind of spin on that harvest planting.
Okay, so
cycle.
The wheel of the year. And these rituals are great in that they connect you to the world of spirit and to the inner self and to the planet in ways that are very powerful and moving. So welcome, Susie. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, John. Wonderful to see you again.
So we are in the time of year that is the time of Samhain,
mm-hmm.
right, which we call Halloween here in the U.S. And Samhain is a very powerful time of year. It's associated with the death of the year.
Mm-hmm.
It's associated with a time when the veils between the worlds are thin.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, you know, we talk about the veils between the worlds being thin and we talk about death. How are those two things related? And why is it why does it happen at this time of the year?
Well, that's a Celtic idea. And the idea is that because it marks the close of the harvest cycle.
Ah, okay. Right.
And the last harvest, basically. And that's the reason we see pumpkins scattered around for Halloween, is they're your last crop. They're the last harvest. Sometimes so the crops in other places. But that's the reason.
Well, like your grain corn would also be, well, no, actually that's the harvest moon kind of thing,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's the last harvest.
It's the last harvest, and from there you're really seeing
The wheel, as we use it in Taoist Wicca, is seen as the solstices, which are the long and short of the day and night. And so you could say that the sun goes through a waxing cycle, growing lighter and lighter toward the apex, which is summer solstice.
Right.
And then from summer solstice, the light declines. And you're following that decline at your last harvest. That's when it begins to get cold. You're driven inward within your home. And the ancients, of course, would live with their livestock and bring them in toward them for the hearth, as well as the extended family. And so everybody kind of got ready to slow themselves down, as if we too were the trees that dropped their leaves.
Okay. So one of the other things that I understand occurred at this time of year was any livestock that wasn't going to make it or was not meant to be kept through until the following spring was slaughtered at this time.
Yes. And that also corresponded with the hunt. They are agricultural ancestors. If you go back 250,000 years, most of that time is actually spent in a Paleolithic hunter-gatherer lifestyle,
right,
where they were nomadic and followed the herds. And so the herds would then be coming upon wherever they were going to winter as well. So you had this beautiful, sanguine representation between hunter and hunted, because occasionally whatever you were hunting turned around and killed a few of you.
Yeah, I guess that was probably true.
You know, and so there was this honor that was between hunter and hunted. And this beautiful story is an illustration of this relationship, is that I was privileged to go to a very well-esteemed priestess's house for a Yule feast with classical foods and so forth from medieval England. And we were served a wonderful first course. I met the gentleman across the table from me, and he told me about having complained to the goddess that he had not gotten a good birthday present. So he walked on the beach and looked down at his feet, and lo and behold, there was a beautiful knife. It was one that you had to pull out. I mean, it was nevertheless a gorgeous knife. And he got so excited, he opened it up, and it cut him.
Hmm.
He took it home, showed it to his wife. She opened it. She cut herself. And so the guy says, I'm going to take this to England and show my friend. And along the way, a couple of customs officers open it, and it cuts them.
Oh, my goodness.
And so it did also his friend when he showed it to him. And he told him the story of how each time, no one has been able to open that knife without it taking blood. And he said, what you have, my friend, is a sacrificial knife. So this is the knife that is only meant to deliver the feast. It's only meant to take blood. And it is, as there was written by Robert Graves, the White Goddess, that's very famous, that he also wrote a companion book, The Dark Goddess. And I just get chills as I mention her. So you had this idea that the goddess was in dual nature. And so you had mentioned before the show that our goddesses are deities of death, also gods of transformation and of rebirth. And I would say to you, absolutely.
So we're going to talk about that some more later in the show.
Yeah.
Okay, so the veils are thin. Why are the veils thin at this time of death?
Okay. Thin between what is the first question.
Okay.
And the answer is that more and more quantum physics is beginning to suspect that we actually have multiple dimensions. And shamans have thought this for thousands of years. They interact with them in the form of spirit guides and nature speaking and enlivening and listening to those systems and rhythms. And so the wheel of the year is actually an attempt to get in rhythm or sync with the seasons, with the earth, and with the pace. Because one of the things that we fail to do is we ramp up for winter when our ancestors knew very well that they should stay indoors, stay warm, well fed, sleep a lot, and get along with each other.
That's interesting.
So, by working with the seasons, you kind of internally balance, come in balance or attune yourself to natural forces that speak through the psyche.
I want to come back to the thinness of the veils.
Okay. So the veil is that hanging curtain, if you will, that semi-permeable membrane between the dimensions.
Oh, okay.
So it is, okay. We call it the world between. So you're between the worlds, but you're also, when you're in that membrane, all time is now, and more so, you're participating with a conscious interaction between the realms of existence, where your power animals, your ancestors, the deities exist, and the other realms of experience that are too subtle for us to name.
Mm-hmm.
But in the process of following this darkening cycle, you're forced to the inroads of your own consciousness. And so you could almost think of it as very roughly equivalent to the moon cycle. A new moon, you begin again. You throw this energy into the waning cycle, into the waxing cycle, the growth cycle. You have full moon, you celebrate what you've done, you ask for more clarity, and then the moon goes into decline, and you turn what you're asking for inward. And so it's about internal growth and resolution and understanding and clarity, not so much the energy you're putting out toward outward things, but about inward things.
Okay.
And so Samhain is that 3 days of the dark moon when you are turned deeply inward so that you can begin to sit in this membrane, in this space between worlds.
So is it the case that the veils between the worlds, or the veil between the worlds, is thinner, or simply that if we follow the natural cycle of things, our access to that world, to that interdimensional space, is enhanced? In other words,
I agree with you, and I think the answer is both and.
Okay.
So I think I do find that people who are don't consider themselves spiritual, don't consider themselves psychic, do find themselves more nostalgic, melancholy perhaps, dreaming more vividly.
Mm.
So having heightened senses, that is potentially, whenever those five senses heighten, that's when you move into the sixth sense.
Well, I think actually, so as I thought about the nature of the question, I kind of asked it from a false premise that they were somehow separate. And if you think about the expression of life that is happening in a cycle, then the expression itself will wax and wane. And therefore the energy associated with external versus internal will wax and wane.
Yes.
And that affects, that is essentially a major aspect or component of our reality.
Mm-hmm.
So if life itself is waxing and waning, then our ability to pass between the worlds, then the veils between the worlds are waxing and waning.
Yes, and our perception is elsewhere.
And our perception is elsewhere, right.
We when the energy is moving outward, it makes sense that the membrane, the veil, that curtain in between them would be a little thicker, because you need to stay on the mortal side of things right at the moment.
Hmm.
Because you're planting and mm-hmm. you've got things to do. It's not time to reflect.
One of the things that I've been doing lately is reflecting very consciously on the correlations of cycles with the breath. Right? With
yes.
our breathing.
Yes, right? That's another rhythm.
And so if you think, if you just think about the inhale as the first part of the year, right, that you're moving away from the place of emptiness,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it's kind of, in a way, it's behind you or away from your momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And when you exhale, you are approaching it. And so your momentum is either carrying you in a direction that's either towards or away from that place of silent introspection,
mm-hmm.
or rest,
mm-hmm.
or dare we say, the stillness of death.
Or emptiness. You're absolutely right. And then I would say, using that metaphor, those last couple of seconds where you know you're running out of breath and must soon take another, but you are just for the bit, a little second, you're empty.
Hmm.
And that is this empty yet ready womb of the goddess. There is, from Samhain's point of view, this pause that all of nature kind of dies with the horned one, the sacrificed in the hunt. And so all of nature kind of becomes still in attendance to the royal death. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm actually moved by it, so I'm
okay.
Absorbing it. Okay, so I want to bring us back to and get our audience a little bit more comfortable with the role of death in this process, because you said so eloquently that space in between is the empty womb of
mm-hmm.
the goddess,
mm-hmm.
right? And when we think of an empty womb, we tend to think of one that is going to be filled.
Mm-hmm.
But there's the other side of that is that it has to be emptied first.
Absolutely. And that's the reason the Celts start the year, Samhain, spelled Samhain, by the way.
Right.
You'll never find it as the way
it's spelled. Sowen.
Right. This idea that once you pull something up and you go through a composting cycle where the death is going to lead to new fertility, space for that next seed. So when you harvest the plant, you cut down its stalk, you conserve its seed, you thrash some of it back into the soil, and it lays there dormant until spring, in which you take that conserved seed, your lessons, and plant toward the new cycle of growth, whatever you want your harvest to be.
So let's focus a little bit on the taking and the making of space.
Yes, because that's Samhain.
Right, and
yeah.
that's where the death function, and we say the word death, even as I say it, I worry that our listeners will be put off by it, but there's something essential and precious
mm-hmm.
about the generosity of life, that it is willing to die to make room for something else, something new. So let's talk a little bit about that dying process and the moment of death.
Okay. Again, back to that Yule feast. After the second course came the main dish, and the priestess, hostess, introduced the sacred hunter who had killed the venison that we were now eating, about to eat. And at first I thought, oh no, I don't know if I want to hear this. But he said that it was ancient hunting custom that you would pray that your totem, the one animal that represented all the animals, would grant you a sacrifice, a willing participant, and that was a royal act. And that was a God-to-God act.
In a way, a sovereign act.
Absolutely. Thank you. That's exactly the word I was thinking.
Right, where the animal willingly chooses to serve
mm-hmm.
as a sovereign choice. It's not
right.
taken.
Right.
It's willingly surrendered.
Right. Back to this Yule story, the hunter decided he would take his grandfather's antique Civil War rifle with him, with his men's circle. And he didn't exactly say, hey, dudes, you know, we're going to do the sacred hunt today. He just brought it along in case he was called. But he had been praying about it. He knew he was soon going to have to take a sacrifice to feed a whole village of people that he lived next door to. His neighbors counted on the meat in this small town in Oregon that he lived in. And so he's walking along, and he sees several stags, and one of them simply stops and stares at him. And he carefully takes aim, without hurry, without rush. He knows by the communication between the two of them that this is his willing sacrifice. The animal simply stood there, passively, sovereignly, and he shot it. And then he most of the time you wait till your prey is dead before you approach it. Well, he approached as the animal was dying, and he held its head kind of in his lap, and he kind of cradled it, and he said he could feel the animal spirit come up through him and out his own crown. And so that's the that's the best way I can answer your question.
Willingly surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
So we could all, I think it's useful to contemplate in our own lives where we and how often we willingly surrender completely, because death is not a partial measure. You know, people often talk about going through a death, you know, either in their career or in relationships or whatever. And, you know, I know in my own walk that it was not trivial to remind myself and hold to the discipline of not trying to hang on to something related to that experience. Because if you're actually still using the same tools and attitudes and social and psychological programming as you are going, quote unquote, going through this death experience of whatever it is, career, relationship, or whatever, you're not really letting go, right?
Right, right.
And that doesn't leave the womb empty.
Right. And that ready womb of the goddess is more accessible, that capacity for empty and filled at the same time, because that emptiness is filled with a knowledge of the supernatural. Instead of a focus on the mundane things and having that space filled like a U-Haul storage unit, then by gradually getting rid of that, the clutter, if you will, the old baggage, then at each cycle, Samhain is an opportunity to reconnect with your ancestors so you don't fear going into the dark time and the death that it brings. Many more people begin to die from now through February. And this is, again, because the veil is thin, getting across is easier.
And your momentum is in that direction.
And your momentum
anyway.
Is in that direction, absolutely. And to, for once a year, set aside an understanding that, yes, we are mortal and we will die.
Yeah.
And that we hold everything, in Wicca, we hold everything as blessings from the goddess on lend lease. We know that they aren't permanent. And in the ritual, what we do, we have been acquiring stones for a basket, stones representing earth and manifestation. And the one stone can represent your home, another your family, your job, things that you're grateful for that you've manifested in your life. And you can take credit for that. And you can say, looky, I'm really happy about this. I'm really proud of this. I'm grateful for this. And then at Samhain, we turn them over and we destroy the baskets. We send them into the afterlife. And the stones go back into the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Or a local river, or they're buried somewhere under
right,
a sacred tree
right.
and fairy mound.
So we're willing, so in a sense, a willingness to give it all up.
A willingness to know that you don't ever hold it. It isn't yours.
It never was. It never was. All right. Well, I think now would be a good time for a short break. And we'll come back and talk a little bit more about the ancestors and some of the deities that take part in this process.
That'll be terrific.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be right back.
We hope you're enjoying this broadcast of Firefly Willows LIVE on Blog Talk Radio. For information on Firefly Willows, please explore our website, fireflywillows.com, or like us on Facebook.
Welcome back. This is Convergence, and I'm your host, John Carosella. And today I'm speaking with Susie Peltier, also known as Lady Red Hawk, Taoist Wiccan priestess and leader of rituals extraordinaire. And we've been talking about Samhain and the power of this time of year and the proximity to death and the role that death plays in this part of the year and also in our lives. So before the break, we were just about to get into discussion about the ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that we do in the Samhain ritual is we honor our ancestors, but we don't honor all of our ancestors. We only honor the dead ones. So why is that? What are we seeking to understand or reveal in working with the ancestors?
I think it bears mentioning that this concept of ancestor worship is timeless and it's cross-cultural. Judaism, for example, is a kind of ancestor worship. And, of course, the Tibetans have it and the Japanese have it and the Mayans have it.
Right, most tribal peoples have it.
Really, most tribal peoples around the world, completely a cross-cultural thing. And I think it's because death is a great mystery. And I'm not sure that we really fear death. I fear more the pain of the transition, perhaps, or leading to the transition than I do the actual crossing over. I've helped enough souls along to not be terribly concerned about being afraid of death. But I do fear pain.
Mm.
You know, I do fear discomfort, and I do fear growing old and a burden and all of those things. So, but each culture would honor their ancestors differently, but frequently ancestors were even just buried under the house. And so you lived in this close proximity of death and you hunted to stay alive. You had to kill something or you had to scavenge something that was already dead in order to live.
You raised livestock, you had to butcher it.
And even before that, you had to kill it on the hoof, or you have to run across it and hope the hyenas don't beat you to it.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay. Mm-hmm.
So this idea that, one, the decay process actually, we understand forensically a lot about the decay process, but it is a composting process where we are returned physically, mortally, to the elements that make up our bodies and reabsorbed into the earth. And we're food for all of nature's critters that help clean things up. In ancient Egyptian tradition, you had a vulture goddess named Nekhbet. And vultures were known, of course, they can have very long, thin necks. They can stick their whole beak into a carcass. And it's a bird of renewal as well as the end of a cycle.
Well, it's interesting because it's almost like the vulture assists us in not holding on to little bits and pieces of the part of us that's dying.
Right, right. And symbolically, or from a Jungian perspective, that death happens with the sacred hunt at Samhain. But this idea that we can't get away from, even if we're goaltending, we still have to compost some ideas. We have to in Tibetan Buddhism, there is this idea, I can't think of the name of it right now, but it is a form, they put out a tantric feast, so they feed the gods and demons, which are thought to be flip sides of the same coin. And here you see a little bit of Taoism, you know, with this flip side to the same coin. So we can't have rebirth until we have death. And so that's the reason that the Celtic year, the Wiccan year, begins in the dark. It begins with this plowing of the soil and plowing under.
Plowing under of the...
Right. Hmm. And so in that this particular meditation that's escaping me at the moment, you call your directions, and then in meditation, you lay yourself out on the great table, and you call in the gods and demons and let them feast. It's a way of letting the hungry ghosts, which are the parts of us that are never satisfied, all of that gets to be satiated. So in a way, we can, in meditation, become that kind of rotting carcass, if you will. And the benefit to that is that it is the ego being fed upon. It is and released. And so you reach a point at which you're kind of looking down at this process or in observing the process, as if you were a spirit having lifted from your body, and now you're seeing the first of the carrion birds to come in to feast. So it's as though you are aware that it's a very thin membrane, and it's very easy to come back and forth, and to someone who's sensitive to be influenced by the other side.
So take us back to the ancestors here at this point.
Okay. The ancestors are our living link. We have in our DNA recollections of antibodies that our ancestors needed to survive things that we don't see much in modern times, and yet DNA, we still have some residual antibodies for those things. So the ancestors can be thought of as quite literally living within us.
That's a cool idea.
Yeah. And so to kind of understand and have compassion for humanity, we have such a painful history, and most of the history that's tremendously painful, we've brought on ourselves. And so it's a time for lessons to be learned. Lessons to be learned individually. And when you turn inward, you can kind of say, wow, I would like to do that better next time if I have a chance. Or I understand, for example, our ancestors were very tribal and territorial. We don't necessarily want the same social structure. Some of our ancestors were slaveholders. Some of our ancestors were slaves. Some of our ancestors did horrible things. If you buy past lives, maybe we've done horrible things.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an opportunity for atonement there, to pray for the past that there be healing. Because even as young as this country, it's got dreadful, dreadful wounds that fail to heal.
Oh, yeah.
Racism, you know, first and foremost.
Well, genocide.
Numerous of them, yes, and cultural genocide on the Native Americans and so on. So it's important to kind of understand that when we connect with our ancestors, I think it opens the heart to a greater compassion.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we look at history closely, these were terrible binds people were in.
Mm.
You know, just terrible binds. And it's been a very long time since we've had a culture, I do believe it once existed, but a culture that understood that it needed to take care of its members. Or a culture that everybody knew the person who passed away. But that isn't so long ago.
No, really.
100 years ago in rural America, you know, you're... Auntie died at home, and then you stretched her out in the coffin in the living room, and you served tea and your neighbors brought you food.
Mm.
And so, you know, you clean them up as best you could, but you got them underplanted as soon as you could, too.
Right.
And we only had antibiotics toward the end of World War II.
Right. So there was a lot more intimacy with death and the dead.
Right.
Not that long ago.
Right. And so that's a tremendous weight upon our consciousness if we don't culturally give ourselves a vehicle to participate in that process.
Mm. Well, so there's an interesting, I want to come back to something that you mentioned. You said that cultures sometimes buried their dead under their house.
Right.
Okay. Now, that's the most, I guess, kind of most extreme example, but the idea that, that's what triggered this thought, right, is that maybe that proximity to death and the dying process, or just the proximity to the bodies, made encountering the spirits of our ancestors more likely or more vivid.
Absolutely. Much easier because there is very little distance between you.
Right.
It's 3 feet of ground or 8 feet of ground.
So there's a mystical, supernatural part of this that we kind of have disconnected ourselves from,
mm-hmm,
by distancing ourselves from death. And we, in a sense, we've distanced ourselves from our ancestors.
Right. We sanitize death, and we've made enormous graveyards that you really have to drive quite some time to get to one. It's not something you see around the corner.
Right.
We've managed to remove ourselves from that, and when a person is dying, they're taken to hospice. You know, now, hospice is a fairly recent development in human history.
Actually, in the idea that we bring the dying home is now just coming back into practice in Western culture, because for a long time we just schlepped them off to the hospital and left them there.
Right.
Hmm.
So an ancestor worship, an honoring of the ancestors, where you know that first of all, on the top level, the surface level, you can call upon the history that you understand from them and the times they lived in and so forth. And calling upon that history helps you. You know, if you're not aware of your history, you're going to repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
So in a number of Native American traditions, the ancestors are considered tutelary spirits. And so they're seen as teachers. And one of the ways you have a teacher is to teach you what not to do as well as what to do.
Right.
And so an ancestor worship is not to be confused with maintaining old ancestral hatreds and grudges and issues, tribalism and so forth.
It's not an excuse for static social consciousness.
Right. And it's also maybe an understanding that back in the Paleolithic times, there's very good evidence now that there were matriarchal cultures, and that the matriarchal cultures ran more to equanimity in the culture, not a reverse patriarchy.
Right.
So it was not a case of women being in charge, but women spreading out the power.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the ways that we commonly honor our ancestors is to examine history. Simply that. Mm-hmm. You know,
So it's a very practical thing. It has its mystical elements, but it also has its very practical elements, which is to bring your focus to what has shaped you.
Right. You as an individual,
mm-hmm,
and to also understand what has shaped your culture.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in this culture, when the culture is so skewed toward patriarchy and in social indifference. You see, one of the things that the ancient cultures did very well was they took care of each other.
Mm.
And that was because everybody had a function.
Yeah, and I want to have a conversation about, for another time, I want to have a conversation about this point that you raised, that there was a greater sense of of interdependency and integration in times past and in tribal cultures. But that's probably for another story.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to, before we run out of time, I want to touch on the deities that, mm-hmm. that accompany Samhain, that show up commonly, that you've seen or that you've experienced in doing the Samhain work, and therefore, I guess, in a way, accompany our understanding of this letting go time.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you got there?
Well, the beauty of, one of the things that I really like about Wicca is that we've managed to piece together a number of different cultures that all kind of have creation and destruction deities. So you can really kind of pick and choose to your taste. Like if you're in the mood for Indian food, you could speak to Shiva and Kalima. And if you're Celtic like me, you know, my patron is Caradhwen, and she's the goddess of the cauldron of death, inspiration, and rebirth.
Mm.
So she is a shamanic goddess in that her story goes that she had an ugly son and a beautiful daughter, and she wanted to give her son wit and knowledge, and so that he would be very wise and thus attractive. And so she put this young man to stirring the straw, and she comes home, and the horses are frightened away. There's a mess, the cauldron's been overturned, and this young man has eaten, whether knowingly or accidentally, 3 drops of the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And so now he has the wisdom she was wanting to impart to her son. So she's furious. And he, being now the young shaman, shapeshifts into all of the animals that are part of the Celtic mythology. She shifts in turn to counter him. Eventually, he becomes a kernel of corn. She becomes a hen. 9 months later, she gives birth.
So she eats him.
Mm-hmm. She eats him, and he becomes the great magician Merlin. So he's born of Caradhwen out of that shamanic transformation.
Hmm.
So one of the reasons that I think we use masks at this time of year is that, again, a very ancient practice was to use masks as a means of understanding that our own identity is not as set and solid as we want, and also that by capturing or invoking a spirit from the mask, one can be guided in a shamanic journey through the underworld by this mask. And so you are letting go of your ego identity, because that's the part that keeps you small.
Mm.
And now we've gone from Beltane, where there was lovemaking and the maypole and this joy in having a body and this lifelong mates, to Samhain, where the goddess is now the widow, the last of her consorts dies in the hunt, and it's a celebration of nature in its primal processes, and there's a tenderness and a love between them that is unspeakable. And so you have the horned one as a deity showing up as coming from the animal totem, and I use Caradhwen. Also, I call upon Hecate, the Greek grandmother goddess. She's known as the Queen of Witches. And I know her as the Heart of Silence. Caradhwen can have a lot to say and can be very charming and have the sharpest witch you can ever find, and hearty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a,
she's Celtic.
There's a strength to her that's just, whoa. And Hecate guards the crossroads of life and death. She's a little bit like Janus, for whom we have January, the god that looked behind and in front at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So she holds a torch to the crossroads. And the other one, the one that we honor first at the outside of our circle, is an Afro-Caribbean, the Orisha, or nature spirit, named Eligua. And he's also the guardian of the crossroads, but specifically of life and death. So you honor him and the ancestors. He's also a trickster patron god that you can put at your doorway with 3 pennies and a cigar and a little shot of rum every once in a while. And he's a very good bouncer. You know, he's a protector spirit.
Hmm.
But you think of him there at the crossroads of life and death. And you think of as Hecate also there with her torch. So they're both crossroads deities, but they come one from Greece and the other one from the Afro-Caribbean traditions.
So I guess there's the cauldron has to be emptied.
Well, or filled with a primal soup, of which you become a part of. Just think of yourself as the hardy carrot, you know, and you get sliced up at Samhain and then thrown in the soup and you simmer and you percolate. And all of that life and death and grief and elation, all of it simmering in this soup with all of your ancestors.
Mm.
And that's the meditation we do while we're sitting in our masks, is to simmer in that primal soup where we realize that now we're celebrating the eternal love.
Oh right, the goddess loses her last consort and has to wait for the god to be reborn.
Yes.
So there, she has to have a willingness and a faith to be empty without her consort.
Yes.
Which is another aspect of acknowledging and accepting the cycle of life and then death.
Right.
So I guess as we wrap up. The supernatural seems to be present for us. And, I was wondering if you had any last story to share.
Well, as a matter of fact, back to that Yule feast. So the hunter has just finished telling us about the sacrifice. And the gentleman across the table leans over to me and he said, I was on that hunting party that day. And he said, and I don't know what possessed me, but I brought my sacred knife with me. The one that cut everyone. And when they had all done their prayers and were ready to quarter the animal, at least so they could carry it down the mountain, they were kind of seeing who's going to do what and who's got this tool and that tool, and he offered his sacred knife and asked the boys to be careful with it. And they came back reporting that it was a most excellent knife. It had done its job and hadn't cut a soul. And so there was a kind of a full circle for me in that dinner of a teaching about Samhain that's kind of irreplaceable, that there are such things as sacrificial moments and sacrificial implements. And there are times in which we know that we are willingly giving something over, that we are willingly letting something, some old way of being or old way of seeing, or even in the flesh, something's dying.
And we make it, in sacrifice, we make it sacred.
Yes, because that's the definition of sacrifice, is to make sacred. And so all of Samhain is this time when if you're feeling nostalgic or restless or thinking more about your great aunt so-and-so and her purple shoes or whatever the deal is, that isn't an accident. These energies are close by. Give them a wink and a nod and light a candle for them and begin to realize that they light the way for you, that everything that you think is set and solid is actually energy. And at the time of Samhain, poof, that energy is released.
That's it. Very good. All right. Susie, thank you so much for spending time with me today. And I hope our audience enjoyed this as much as I did.
I had a terrific time. Thank you for having me.
And for those of you who might want to reach out to Susie and learn more about Taoist Wicca, or in particular Samhain, her contact information will be on the Firefly Willows LIVE website and the post associated with today's show. Thanks so much. We'll be right back.
Introducing theshamanist.com. Shamanism has been described as archaic techniques of ecstasy because of its capacity to connect us to the divine. John Caracella has been working with shamanic techniques since 2003, developing his skills in healing and counseling. Now, we invite you to take advantage of what he's learned. New in November is The Shamanist, John's website for his personal healing and counseling practice. Visit theshamanist.com to learn more about the services John offers for individuals and teams. Gentle healer, compassionate adventure guide, and thoughtful counselor, John can help make a difference in your life. Visit theshamanist.com for more details. theshamanist.com.
Welcome back. This is Convergence, and I'm your host, John Caracella. So, death, my ally, a little bit more about my experience with death. My first conscious awareness that death was a willing ally was when I finally realized it was time for me to leave my high-tech career. I realized I wasn't leaving, as we tend to think of it. I was dying. As often as I've heard people say, it was like a death, in describing some kind of change in their lives, I didn't know the first thing about it. So I spent some time in the company of death, contemplating what it meant. The first and most important thing I learned from death is that you can't hold on. If you hold on, death can't help you very well. Surrender is probably the most important word here. To accept that an irreversible change is coming, and that you don't know how it will turn out, and that it might just be really uncomfortable, but to surrender anyway. Imagine being in the womb. Imagine what faces the soon to be born, from comfort, safety, and security to discomfort and the unknown. We've all experienced this kind of surrender. This kind of death, just to get here. We don't remember it. Funny how that is. There seems to be something about death that erases our memory. Perhaps because of the anxiety. Anyway, that's what I had to do. I had to surrender to what was coming, even though I didn't know what it would be. I had to let go of my notions of control. For me, very hard to do. Very hard to stay confident that I was doing the right thing by letting go. My exit from my career, from my last job in the field that had sustained me and my family for 25 years, happened over a period of 9 months. During that time, I watched myself become less and less integrated, less and less relevant, less and less important to all that I had participated in for the previous quarter century. I watched my footprint shrink and my shadow dim. And to die well, I had to allow it. I had to encourage it. And I had to not plan. This was the second major lesson I received. When you die, you don't have a plan for what comes next. You don't line up interviews or schedule your week or plan for the future to have something to do. Because you're dead. After you die, you're dead. So part of the surrender isn't just the before it happens, leading up to the event part. It's also consciously not asserting your will in the after it happens part. Otherwise, it's not a death. Because after you die, there is nothing to do. I'm not saying that people don't leave careers and relationships and many other things. I just think that to die to any of those is to surrender and not have a plan. How long do you stay dead? Well, in the Celtic Wiccan Wheel of the Year, you stay dead until Yule, right around the winter solstice. You stay dead until the dark half of the year is over and the light begins to return. And in the way of the natural world, that's when things begin to renew themselves invisibly beneath the soil. How long do you stay dead to a career? Well, to the old one, likely forever. When do you start the process of renewal? Spiritually, it starts invisibly beneath the soil when the light starts to return. After all the charge of your previous career is drained away, and the battery is well and truly dead. Frightening? Yeah, I suppose it is. But the key is to have faith that the natural cycles will support you, and that the moment the light begins to return, your battery will begin to recharge. Your career energies, lying inert, as the shell of your old way of being is composted back into the soil of your life, will reemerge and find a new seed to nourish and inspire and vitalize. If you don't embrace death, though, you never really let go of the old. You never really get to gather all of yourself again, freshly deconstructed, freshly freed, freshly aligned to re-enter the world as new. Now, don't get me wrong, we have to eat, we want shelter. In our culture, that usually means we need money, and that usually means we need a job. But a job is not a career. Staying dead to the career channel in us does not mean no job, no money, no food. It means, I think, no plan until the charge is completely drained away. It doesn't have to last long, but I knew that if I didn't feel it go empty, I wouldn't fully die. And I had to die. It was a strange feeling, as folks knew I was leaving, to say no to offers for leads to other jobs at other companies, or even to say no to brainstorming opportunities or social events that might lead to a fruitful connection. Because when you die, you're dead. Inert. There is no after for that part of you that has died. I can't tell you how important that part was for me. Because there's a temptation to stay with what you know, with where you're comfortable, that stops you from letting go, from entering the void, from truly dying. I had an experience of entering the void. It was just as I was realizing that I had to end my career. May of 2009, I was doing some deep journey work and I was led to a place of stillness. Slowly, gradually, my body and mind slowed down. My breathing slowed, and my heart. I don't know how long this process lasted, but eventually, everything stopped. I was inert. My body was completely still. Slumped in a lawn chair in my backyard under a full moon, I was, I believe, dead. And then I was in this place where there was nothing, and I was nothing. Indescribable, really. Because just as there was nothing, this place was not empty. Not at all. It was brimming. It was nothing, and yet it was brimming. It was stillness itself, but it was ecstatic. Looking back, I can imagine what it must have been like to be the universe just before the Big Bang. I was there only for a moment of eternity. Just for a moment, I was in the void. And then something back where my body was shifted. I must have slumped a bit further in my chair because air was expelled through my throat and my body made a noise. Kind of a... And in that moment, a spark. I witnessed a beautiful yellow, gold, white, red spark that spread from the center of my awareness and the center of my body, my solar plexus, I think, both at the same time. And I startled myself and I made another noise, another cough, and another spark. And then I exhaled with a rattling cough that became a hum, something like that primordial sound of... And light flooded through my consciousness, my awareness, and my body. And I was alive again, out of the void, and into myself. And death, standing silently to my left, barely nodded. Thanks for joining us for today's show. Before I leave you, Just two quick announcements. The first, as you heard earlier in today's show, I'm launching a new personal website called theshamanist.com. It's a new website, so it's bound to have a few quirks. And I would be very grateful if you have the time, if you would go to theshamanist.com, check it out, and offer me some feedback. All of your feedback would be welcome. In particular, I sincerely welcome your feedback on the kinds of services and information that you think it might be fun for us to share. And finally today, a shout out to my amazing daughter, who in a period of 14 days produced a full-length fantasy novel, 82,000 words of amazing storytelling. I'm just so proud of her, and I see very big things in her future. So that's it. I look forward to your feedback on theshamanist.com. Thank you so much for tuning in, and don't miss our call-in show next week. Have a great week.
Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. Join us next week as John Carosella and Mildred Lynn McDonald host our live on-air readings call-in show. Call in or listen as our hosts use their tools of psychic messages, runes, intuitive coaching, animal medicine, and energy healing to offer guidance for your life's path. This is Deb Carosella. Please join us next Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Time on Firefly Willows LIVE, Blog Talk Radio.